Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings, everybody, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the April 9th, 2011 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. We're committed to having you on board the show today as well. You're invited to be a part of what we're talking about today. Join us by phone, as always, dialing 321-768-1240, star 1240 if you're a local Space Coast AT&T wireless customer, or if you're more comfortable with email, our address is spacetalking@aol.com. Appreciate your questions and comments and suggestions for future shows. We've been doing quite a bit of different topics here the last few weeks, getting good response, and sure would appreciate knowing what you'd like to hear more about as we continue on through the year. Well, let's see. Did you go to bed early last night and wake up this morning and find out that the government is still with us? The government did not shut down last night. It looks like they've got a few more days to play and come to another compromise and extend it yet one more time. It looks like, though, this is the deal that's been made, and we should be out of the woods in terms of government funding and all the government contractor jobs not going on furlough. Pain in the rear, if anything else. Don't know how you all feel about it. I'm just glad that everyone's going to be back to work on Monday. And in part because there is a variety of celebrations planned for Tuesday, April 12th, to recognize some major historical events that would have been postponed had the government shut down. I'm glad now that we can celebrate these events on the days that are on the day that it was meant to celebrate. Tuesday, April 12th, big day in the history of the space program, the world's space program, because on April 12th, 1961, Yuri Gagarin, the Russian Soviet cosmonaut, became the first man to circle the Earth in a in his spacecraft. Circle the Earth, orbit the Earth. There's always a little confusion about that, a little controversy. I've always got a kick out of did he orbit the Earth? Did he do one revolution of the Earth? And how did he define it? Because basically, the story is where he lifted off from Earth at Baikonur Cosmodrome, and he went around the Earth one time. He actually landed west of the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. And so he never actually completed a full circle. But then again, the Earth rotates beneath him in one orbit. And, you know, so how do you line all that up? And I always got a kick out of that. You know, that's being really nitpicky, though. The bottom line is Gagarin was the first man in space. The Soviets beat the United States. That begat the moon race and Apollo and all the other things then that came out of that. We could do hours on the history of the space program from there. But suffice it to say, Gagarin's flight 50 years ago on April 12th, again, you know, it was shuttle. It was Apollo, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Skylab, Apollo Soyuz, shuttle. In terms of all the manned programs, the incredible amount of unmanned programs that also became a part of that time that we can celebrate, because a lot of them had to do with the manned program. A lot of them had to do with supporting the manned program in terms of studying the moon and reconnoitering. Even now today for trips to Mars. And then, of course, you look at the shuttle era for the last 30 years, and Tuesday, April 12th, is the 30th anniversary of the first space shuttle flight. John Young and Bob Crippen lifting off from the launch pad here at Kennedy Space Center 30 years ago, April 12th. Still two more flights to go, so it's not like the program's over yet. But, you know, I grew up on Apollo. My whole working career has been spent on the space shuttle. And, you know, like many of you in terms of the shuttle, you know, we've seen it at its worst. We've seen it at its best. And I think after 30 years, you know, history is beginning to judge what that vehicle has meant for us. And yes, it we got to be honest, it has never delivered on the promise of cheap, routine access to space. The notion that the shuttle would fly, you know, once a week, which is kind of what the idea was when they first launched, they had schedules that literally, you know, tracked dozens and dozens of payloads. Launching as we put everything in one basket, we were going to launch everything that America owned on the shuttle. Flying once a week, ludicrous today, obviously. You know, we're not even 134 flights, 133 flights, something like that. You know, that is not over 30 years anywhere near a rate of once a week, let alone once a month. And the shuttle turned out to be expensive. It turned out to be risky. It turned out to be, in a way, a dangerous machine to fly. But you know what? That's the risk you take, and that's the vehicle we got. And you know, when that thing gets into orbit, and all the engines shut down, and they open the payload bay doors, that thing has been the most remarkable machine mankind has ever created for operating in space. The things it's allowed us to do. To learn about living and working in space, to gain the experience and just going to visit the Mir space station initially, and then the experience of coming together with the Russians and the international partners in building this space station, this incredibly huge structure, one major piece after the other. This has been an absolutely remarkable program, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. You know, we've learned so much. We've gotten so much from it. We don't want to list all this. We could list spinoffs. Everyone gets cliche about spinoffs, you know, and this medical thing and that gadget and this process and this life-saving thing and all that. Not to diminish the value of that at all. It's just so overwhelming what our space program has done, not only through the whole 50 years, but certainly the things that have come directly out of the space shuttle program. And so, where do we sit now here? Well, the third thing that's going to happen on Tuesday, according to all reports, is that NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden is going to announce where the orbiter fleet is going to be retired to, which site it's going to go to. And everyone's still making stories. Everyone still wants it in their museum. And all the stories are coming out now from every corner. I saw one from Chicago today. That Chicago wants one and thinks they should have one and all the reasons why. But if you want to think about in terms of an NFL mock draft, let's call it this, the space shuttle mock draft, here is my predictions as to where they're going to go. We'll check in together next week and see what happens. I think Discovery, obviously going to the Air and Space Museum as promised. I think the Space Shuttle Endeavor is going to stay here at the Kennedy Space Center, be part of the visitor complex. I think Atlantis is going to be going to the Air Force Museum at Wright-Patterson in Dayton, Ohio. And I think Enterprise will be taken out of the National Air and Space Museum and shipped west to Seattle to the Museum of Flight out there. I think New York gets skunked. I don't think Johnson Space Center gets one either. Agree, disagree, let me know what you think. I think that's what the lineup is going to be. And could give you some very good reasons why each one of those should go where they're going to go, or why I believe that. So 30 years of shuttle, 50 years of human spaceflight, and an incredible future still ahead of us, a future that's going to involve commercial spaceflight. So when we return from our first break, we're going to be joined by Alan Stern, a planetary scientist who has embraced the world of commercial spaceflight and has plans to fly himself suborbital one day very soon. Plus your comments and questions as well along the way. Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Yeah. And indeed, welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. And it's a good afternoon here on Florida's Space Coast. Sunny day. Wonderful time to get together and chat about our space program again as we celebrate so many great anniversaries this week. And just, I hope just everyone really takes a chance to think about their space program and where we've come from in 50 years and where we're headed to. And where we're headed to is just as exciting, even though I think and others are going to agree with me that it's going to look very different than the past 50 years in terms of who is doing what and who is flying what. And to help talk a little bit about that, my guest today is a planetary scientist, a former associate administrator for NASA's Science Mission Directorate. He's currently with the Southwest Research Institute's Space Science and Engineering Division, where he is an associate vice president, and he's an all-around, another one of these great space guys, all-around good guys, Alan Stern. Alan, welcome to Space Talk.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Good to have you on board, finally. Let's get started by, first of all, giving folks a sense of who you are. You know, we're a launch operations center around here, and maybe folks aren't as familiar with you and your background. Tell me about how you became into Space Cadet and what you're up to, and how'd you get here?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure how I started. I can't remember that far back. I've always been interested. I grew up as a kid during Apollo and wanted to get into the space program, went to college in physics and aerospace engineering, and, you know, after I took my master's degree, I went off into the Reagan Defense Build-Up and then into building scientific instruments and got more and more interested in the research, the science side, and eventually went back to graduate school for a PhD in astrophysics. And then I built the planetary program at Southwest Research in our Boulder office, which mm-hmm. is about 80 people now. PI'd a whole slew of missions from suborbital up to, the Pluto mission, crossing the solar system, shuttle experiments, things like that. Went off to NASA headquarters to work for Mike Griffin as one of the four associate administrators of NASA, mm-hmm. Running the Science Mission Directorate. And then since leaving the agency, I've gone back to my research career and have also become heavily involved in human commercial spaceflight.
Yeah, you know, you wear a lot of different hats and still do, and I know that feeling. You know, we can talk to you about so many different things. Commercial spaceflight, though, really seems to be the most interesting thing to me about what you're working on right now, and the idea that very soon you hope to be flying on, let's say, Virgin Galactic or X-Corps Lynx vehicle. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, happy to. When I came back to Southwest Research, I made the case that the coming suborbital, commercial reusable suborbital era is really going to be important for research and for being a first-rank research organization in the space sciences, that we had to get into it. And the Institute liked that story very much and is invested in it. We have a program that I think is out ahead of everybody else in the research field. We've already selected three payload specialists and bought 8 seats between X-Corps and Virgin for initial flights. Mm-hmm. We've put together 3 flight experiments. We have options for up to 9 more seats. In those contracts, we have paid for those seats and are moving towards flights that we hope could begin as early as late next year.
You know, and I don't want to gloss over just that one statement, because that is, to me, was profound. When I read your release, the Southwest release, I think it was dated in February of this year, and saw posted online, I literally did a double take at the screen that for the first time, you know, a private organization like Southwest Research is going to another private commercial organization to gain access to space to do experiments without going through NASA, without going through the government, without going through any of that, whatever you want to call it, or however you want to characterize it. That is the wave of the future. And I think it really brings a lot of credibility to what the Virgin Galactic guys are doing and the whole concept of commercial human spaceflight, whether it's suborbital or orbital, I don't really care at this point, just to get that whole thing going. I mean, I think you've really done a remarkable thing, and as they say, you're not even off the ground yet.
Well, thank you very much. We are very proud to lead in this, and our ambitions are pretty high. This is a first step for us. We expect a lot more suborbital flights with research to follow these, and we're looking forward to orbital someday as well. It's really a very bright future out there in commercial space, and I think it's more than just tourism. The research and education applications are just tremendous. I know there are media and other applications as well, so it's a bright future in the 21st century.
So what are you hearing then from your friends out there in, I guess, New Mexico? That would be the launch site. Are you on track to fly 2012, 2013, or are there even dates yet?
Well, you know, when we fly on X-Core, we'll fly out of Mojave, and when we fly out of with Virgin, we'll fly out of New Mexico.
Okay.
And there aren't really dates yet. These are test programs. Neither vehicle has flown to space yet. And it's anybody's guess what precise year and month it'll be. But I'd be surprised if we weren't flying 2 years from now, and I would not be surprised if we were flying 18 months from now.
If you were, and when you fly like this, you know, I picture shuttle, I picture a black box on a mid-deck locker, and an astronaut turns a button every once in a while. But, you know, in the relatively brief suborbital flight, is the thing in your lap that you're operating it? Is it in a box in front of you? I mean, how do you envision doing science in that short period of time?
Well, it's not such a short period of time. Try holding your breath 3 or 4 minutes. And I'm used to zero-G parabolas of 20, 25 seconds on the airplane
right.
that I've been flying since I was a summer intern at Johnson, literally 30 years ago. And we've flown a lot of sounding rocket missions, and we're used to producing very good science in a short period of time. The experiments are almost unlimited, and I don't know that we have time to go forward thinking about all the things that can happen. The first three that we'll be flying are a biomedical harness. In fact, it's a shuttle harness to help the docs take a look at how people react to onset of zero-G, a variety of physiological parameters. We have a image-intensified camera that's going to help us determine how well these vehicles are suited to doing upper atmospheric science and some kinds of astronomy. And we have a microgravity experiment that's more or less a glove box type experiment. But that's just the training wheels for much, much bigger things to come.
Mm-hmm. Now, you start talking about commercial crew opportunities to the, you know, taking these experiments to the International Space Station, for example, now a national laboratory. One could almost envision a private company having a contract to provide services at the space station that Southwest could contract with. And again, I don't know what NASA's involvement or the international partners' involvement would be with that. Would they get in the way, or do they get out of the way? I mean, how do you characterize kind of where this is all going? Where do you think this is all going, and what are the bumpy roads ahead, if any?
Well, I'm sure it's a bumpy road, and I'm sure we can't predict where it's going any more than the early adopters in the computer industry knew where it was all going in 1979 or 1980. I do foresee the kind of thing you're talking about at ISS, and I know that Bill Gerstenmaier and his ISS team, Mark Uran and so forth, are interested in commercial applications up on the ISS. There's also Bigelow. There are also Dragon missions that may or may not go someday to space station or even to any station that may just operate out of the crew cabin. And I think there'll be more vehicles coming along from Boeing and from Orbital and probably others. We hear about Sierra Nevada, Blue Origin, others. I think it's almost unlimited. I think by the 2020s, it's going to be, let's just call it the Roaring 20s. That's what I'm looking forward to.
That's a great way to look at it. Well, and my biggest concern here is we talk about this transition to, you know, NASA seems to be making the attempt to embrace the commercial world and contracting for services. There's contracts out there. There's programs out there. You know, we're watching Falcon and we're watching the Taurus and other things like that. Are you you've seen both sides. You see the big picture. Are you comfortable with where NASA's at and their thinking? Is there still some folks over there that still need to get it yet? Or, I mean, what do you think about all that?
I'm pretty comfortable with the agency's leadership. I think it's forward-looking, and I think they realize that we shouldn't be sending our precious dollars to Russia to fly our crew. If we can help it, it ought to be an American industry and American jobs, American innovation. I think they get it. In fact, I know they get it, that we need to lower our expenses to get back and forth to LEO so that we can spend more of our precious dollars getting beyond LEO, finally, 40 years after Apollo. Mm-hmm. And commercial space enables that. These lower-cost systems like Musk has built on SpaceX, you know, Falcon 9 and Dragon were developed on about the same budget as the Ares launch tower. And a lot of people in NASA are very excited about a future where we can get back to having dirty boots doing science on the moon, on asteroids, eventually to Mars. I know there are some that don't believe that story. They don't have confidence in the commercial industry. And to them, I know their heart's in the right place, but I suspect that they're on the wrong side of history because we just can't afford these old, slow, expensive systems that oftentimes don't make it off the drawing board. And we just end up rebooting every 7 or 8 years with a new acronym and a new program that never really flies.
Yeah, yeah. Alan, let's stand by here just right there. We're going to take a pause for our five-minute built and hold at the bottom of the hour. Nick, I acknowledge you on the line here with a question about Falcon 9. We'll get to you right after this break. We'll get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And then when we return, we will continue our chat with Alan Stern. Space Talk brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Bankey.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk right here on WMMB, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. And on the line from his home in Boulder, Colorado, right where they're getting ready a few miles south there to hold the National Space Symposium this week, sponsored by the Space Foundation, is the Southwest Research Institute's Space Science and Engineering Division Vice President and all-around good guy, Dr. Alan Stern. Alan, again, welcome back to Space Talk. We're glad to have you with us today. And if you want to talk about Falcon 9, Nick on line one here has a question for you about Falcon 9. Nick, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Welcome.
And by the way, compliments, Jim. This has been a very, very interesting, in fact, exciting discussion so far about the pending future of privatization of space access in many ways. I think the commoditization of access to LEO is crucially important. It's going to be transformational. And, Alan, you may know me from unmannedspaceflight.com. This is Nick Prevacic, from also known as NPREV.
Hey, Nick. Nice. How you doing?
Really good, really good. And I just had a question for you, actually, about the announcement from SpaceX this week about Falcon 9 Heavy. What do you think the impacts of that may be on unmanned spaceflight efforts in general as far as improving affordability for more diverse missions, certainly more missions potentially? Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. I think Falcon 9 is going to be transformational for human space exploration, but I also think, and in fact, I'm writing an op-ed right now on the very subject of your question, because Falcon 9's much lower price points and much higher performance is going to open up a lot of new possibilities within NASA Science Mission Director. Once the vehicle is up and flying and proven, it's going to be the kind of cost competition that I think S&D really needs. There's been a lot of increases in launch costs, and this is a way to get back basically to Delta II launch prices, but with half the power of Saturn V.
Yeah.
And that has all kinds of benefits, launching multiple payloads in a single shot, sharing rides with commercial satellites, designing missions that don't have to be so weight-constrained, and that can save you on engineering cost. And then the high performance that this vehicle offers, particularly for sample return missions, for heavy observatories, things like that, are potentially game-changing for Science Mission Directorate, for ESA, for other agencies. And since Ariane really can't compete with it, I think it's going to be great for American jobs.
Yeah, that's great. Nick, thanks for your question and your comments and for listening.
Absolutely.
Alan, you know, talk about SpaceX and talk about Elon and some more about Falcon 9. You know, the thing you mentioned something about the development of the rocket was for them, I guess, was the Falcon 9 was less expensive for that company than it was when building the Ares 1 launch tower that sits at the Kennedy Space Center right now, basically unused. I don't know what those numbers are. I trust that those numbers are accurate if you're using them. But what I've never really been able to get my arms around, again, more as a layman than anything else, is why SpaceX is so inexpensive. Is it the contracting methods? Is it the lack of oversight? And I don't mean that in a bad way, but you know, the oppressive oversight of paperwork and quality control and whatnot. What is it about SpaceX that they're allowed that they can do this and set these price points?
Well, you know, the story I told about the price comparison with the Ares launch tower is not urban legend. Those are real numbers. But SpaceX has found the formula. They're not the only ones. You know, Burt Rutan at Scale Composites won the XPRIZE, spending $30 million to conceive, invent, test, fly, and win the XPRIZE with the first commercial human piloted system to go to space and back with Spaceship One and White Knight One. $30 million. We can't build oftentimes a spectrometer to fly on a NASA science mission for that cost.
In fact,
we could name more examples of lemur programs that don't get up that cost asymptote of the watchers watching the watchers watching the watchers that cost you so much money for very small increases in reliability.
Plus the fixed price contracts versus cost plus and incentives and all that. There are different contracting methods that allow certain things to start creeping in, and I imagine that's part of it as well.
Well, you're absolutely right. Cost plus. I remember being PI on an instrument, a very successful instrument by a very successful aerospace firm, and no matter what I did, that cost kept going up. Mm-hmm. And I remember the project manager once showed me a curve. It was shaped like a U, where the vertical axis was the cost, and he drew a dot right at the bottom of the U, and he said, "You are here, and complexity is going left and right. And if you descope, it's going to cost you more money because I have to redo drawings and requirements and test procedures. And if you add, it's going to cost you more money. Wherever you are is always the minimum." And that's the problem with cost plus.
Yeah.
And when somebody makes a mistake, the government pays for it in cost plus. When they drop something, have to repeat a test for whatever reason. When the requirements change, the costs go up. When things don't go as well as you expect, when a supplier doesn't supply, all those things and many more drive the cost, because cost plus means that the government is along for the ride. It's something akin to a hostage situation financially. You have to be along for the ride to finish the project, or forgive the sunk costs and walk away from it.
Right.
And that's not a good deal for space exploration, much less the taxpayer.
Well, and you look at the Falcon 9 now, too, from a technology standpoint. I mean, strapping three of the core vehicles together, there's something about 27 main engines lighting off all at once.
You mean that Falcon Heavy?
The Falcon, when I'm talking Falcon 9 Heavy, yeah, absolutely. That just seems incredible. And I know it can be done, but it just seems so... It seems just too much.
I would not bet against Elon Musk. You know, I was watching when he was early stage, and Falcon 1, he signed up for that with his own money, his own fortune, went out and got some other investors, but he had his own skin in the game, and the first Falcon 1 failed to get to orbit.
Right.
And I expected that he had planned on that, and I was not surprised, but I was glad to see he stood up for number two. And number two didn't get to orbit, and I was, at that stage, pleasantly surprised that he stood up and went for number three and stuck with it. And when number three didn't get to orbit, that guy stood up again and showed the metal in his spine and went back to the table for space exploration and for his company and put the fourth one up, which they got to work,
as
did the fifth one and as did the first two Falcon 9s in a row.
Yeah, and
he's really impressed me.
And those Falcon 1s, even the ones that were, you can call them partial failures, I mean, they didn't necessarily deliver the payload, but they were so close and they got so much done. And you know, Alan, the time when I thought that Elon and that whole team over there were true steely-eyed missile men was that time when the Falcon 1 aborted on the pad. They figured out what went wrong. They topped off the tanks, and they launched again. They tried launching again, and they made it off the pad.
I remember that one. I think it was last year in a Falcon 9 flight, but there might have been a Falcon 1 like that.
There was a Falcon 1 like that as well, and I couldn't believe that they had a system that could do that. You look at any of our Delta, Atlas, you know, Titan shuttle, you fire up the main engine, you're done for a week if you turn that thing off at that point. You know, I mean,
you know, a lot of the commercial space industry is looking that way. I know in the suborbital arena, which is sort of the minor leagues, but nonetheless, that's where a lot of innovation takes place in baseball.
Right.
It's where a lot of innovation is going to take place in human spaceflight. People are designing vehicles to be more or less gas and go. I was in Orlando in your neck of the woods yesterday,
yeah,
and marveling that the aircraft that I flew back on taxied up to the gate, let everybody off, fueled up, turned around, and we were gone in 45 minutes. And
right.
I thought, why can't we design space vehicles to do that?
You know, it's got to be close.
Because we have the wrong mindset. We have to get to that era if we're going to have ubiquitous space flight.
You know, and I want the solar power satellites, and I want mining asteroids, and I want the large structures in space, and I want all those things that, you know, 100 pounds to orbit, you know, $100 per pound to orbit is going to deliver for you. And I look at Falcon 9, and it gets so close. You know, it gets getting there.
I think the future is very bright. SpaceX is leading the way, but there are a lot of other leaders. You look around at X-Core and Virgin,
yeah,
and Blue Origin and Masten and Armadillo, and what's going on at Orbital and what's going on at Boeing these days. And ULA is very innovative in some of its forward-thinking work. And I see it springing up everywhere now. It's starting to go viral.
Well, and of course, you're in Boulder. You can see it from everywhere. We're biased here at the Cape because they launched from our backyard. So we always keep an eye on SpaceX pretty good, and they're great, great community people. By the way, with just about another minute to go here before we have to say goodbye to you, give us a quick update. You're the principal investigator on the New Horizons spacecraft on its way to Pluto. Messenger just dropped into orbit around Mercury. It must make you salivate a little bit to get your probe to Pluto.
Oh, yeah. We've been working on this since the late 1980s. We launched in 06. Spacecraft's in great health, lots of fuel on board, working on only the primary systems, not using any of the backups. The same day that Messenger dropped into orbit around Mercury is the very day that we crossed the orbit of Uranus outbound.
Oh, really?
And we will be on final approach to Pluto 4 years from now.
Wow.
I can't wait.
Wow, that's really something. And, you know, to maintain the career and the interest in the team, it's just got to be just something really neat, too. Christmas time and whatever other holiday times you celebrate together must be really fun to anticipate all that. So
it is, and people love first-time exploration, and this is exploration at its greatest.
Absolutely, absolutely. Alan, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it. We're going to say goodbye to you right now. Well wish you, and we'll be in touch again with more stuff to come with you, okay?
All right, Jim.
Thanks, Alan.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
You too. Okay, we take our final break now. And stay tuned for an update from Space Florida. Plus, we'll have our weekly launch forecast segment. This is Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. Space Talk also brought to you today by the folks at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, who invites you to go online and pick up tickets for a pair of special events coming up. First of all, May 5th is the 50th anniversary celebration of America's first astronaut to fly in space, none other than Alan Shepard. And then on May 7th, the annual U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place here, this year honoring veteran shuttle astronauts Carl Bobko and Susan Helms. All the details are online at kennedyspacecenter.com. Well, now we turn to our friends at Space Florida. The director of spaceport operations, Patrick McCarthy, joins us by phone. Pat, how are you this weekend?
Doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me on again.
You bet. Well, what's new at Space Florida, and what's new at Cape Canaveral? I guess we had a neat rocket announcement we've been talking about.
We did. It was pretty exciting to hear about SpaceX and the Falcon Heavy rocket, because that's going to fly from Cape Canaveral. I know you mentioned his demo flight or two is going to go out of Vandenberg, and that's great. But he does intend to bring it to the Cape to fly it from Complex 40, because that's going to be where all the big business is for those geosynchronous communication satellites. And we've been working with SpaceX for several years and providing them assistance, both monetary and equipment terms. And in fact, this week we finalized another agreement with them for some more assistance and help to fit out their complex 4D processing facility with some upgrades to help accommodate their Dragon capsule.
Really?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, these are the kinds of things that are they're similar to the support that we're offering to all of the bidders in NASA's commercial crew delivery, that CCDEV program. I mean, all the bidders have come to us asking for, you know, what can the state of Florida do for them? And we're working deals with all the candidates. And as part of their proposals to NASA, each of them, or almost all of them, are going to include a letter of support from the state. Now, Space Florida goes out, and we coordinate the all the capabilities available here at the spaceport from KSC, from the Air Force 45th Space Wing, and from commercial companies around the state. And we bring together this package of support, and that helps all these bidders to develop a better business case.
Now, do you know, in the case of SpaceX and the Falcon 9 Heavy, any additional construction they'll need to do out at 40 to accommodate the bigger booster? And if so, you know, to what extent does the state of Florida able to help in making you know, those funds available or help build the out there?
Well, and we'll certainly help them secure engineering talent if they need it. Certainly any equipment purchases and things, you know, there's going to be they'll probably need bigger tanks for their fuel and oxidizer, any of the modifications to the launch pad itself. We may be able to assist them with that, help them find financing for those kinds of things so that the overall price to them stays low. So that's the kind of thing we're going to intend to help them with.
Any current, don't mean to hit you blind with this question, any current of interest, ripple effect when Falcon 9 was announced, the Heavy was announced this past week, from your other customers checking in really quick or showing an interest in doing something maybe that they hadn't shown an interest before? Or, you know, can you gauge any kind of industry reaction to that?
Well, I certainly have heard, you know, some back channel stuff about what the other launch providers are interested in doing and how they intend to remain competitive with SpaceX and things that they can do to maybe change their operating model a little bit and get a little bit more efficient and lower in price. So I think that we'll see some of those things. And again, we're working with all the major providers and some of the smaller ones and the newer companies as well to help them improve their business case by offering them either incentives or financing or just things like equipment loans that we can get surplus from NASA or the Air Force and then make them available to these companies. That helps them lower their bottom line cost, and then that gives them a lower per launch price.
Yeah, interesting. Just to wrap up here, we've got a really interesting audience listening today, thanks to our guest, Alan Stern. Folks that may not have ever interfaced with Space Florida before but want to know more, how do they get a hold of you guys to learn about what you can do to offer them help?
Take a look at our website at spaceflorida.gov or give us a call at 321-730-5301 and ask to speak to our business development office, and they'd be glad to talk to you. Or if you want to give me a call, you know, I'm at that same number. So call me, and we'll get you in touch with the right folks and get you on the path to profitability.
Just ask for Pat.
That's right.
Okay, very good. Pat McCarthy, thanks for being on with us again. We'll check in with you again real soon, okay?
You're welcome, Jim. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. There goes Pat McCarthy, Director of Spaceport Operations for Space Florida. Time now to take our weekly look at the launch forecast brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, the big change since last week is that the next launch from the Cape now expected, well, it's still Space Shuttle Endeavour on its final mission to the International Space Station. Liftoff from Kennedy Space Center's launch pad 39A now targeted for Friday, April 29th at 3:47 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We had hinted at this before. The NASA manager is discussing traffic control, space traffic at the space station. With the comings and goings of Soyuz spacecraft and Progress resupply spacecraft. And when the dust all settled on that, the decision was made to delay the shuttle 10 days to smooth things out up there. There's a Progress resupply vehicle that is scheduled to depart from Baikonur on April 27th. So by the time that lifts off and docks with the space station a couple of days later, then that will clear the way then for Endeavour to launch and get on its way. I mentioned the Soyuz launch. It did take place this past Monday night, and two cosmonauts and one astronaut flying up there to the space station. So that happened, and of course, since we're not using shuttle anymore, I want to make sure that you're aware of that our own NASA astronaut, in this case Ronald Guerin, was successfully launched into space, and they have since docked to the space station. I was hoping for that April 19th launch. It's not going to happen. That was going to be a launch right at sunset. Oh, well, you got to go when you got to go. And so there you go. Also, just kind of showing up on the radar, May 5th is an Atlas V launch from 2:25 to 3:05 in the afternoon, 2:25 in the afternoon. That will be a early missile warning system satellite that we'll talk about more as we get closer to that launch. A wrap up again today, then a reminder, Tuesday going to be the big day celebrating 50 years of human spaceflight, the space shuttle's legacy, and keep an eye out, an announcement on the shuttle retirement and where each orbiter goes. Remember my pick, Endeavour, for the Kennedy Space Center, and we'll see if that happens. So that's about it for now. Space Talk is sponsored by Space Florida and is a production of Myla Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer for Space Talk. Up next now on WMMB is the Home Mortgage Law Show. So please do stay tuned for that. Thanks again for everyone for listening. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.